There's an opening for you. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And that is a polka sitar-style version of our theme song, which comes to us from Steve Simi Siemens from Minnesota. And he writes, "Thanks for the theme clip. Well, my little experiment is complete. Per the suggestions from the show, I incorporated accordion and sitar sounds into a pretty goofy version you might get a kick out of. My apologies to Chris Cullman for destroying his vision. I hope he will think of it as a cartoon of his work, and remember, imitation is the highest form of flattery." I think it'll be all right. What do you think?
I think it'll be just fine.
All right. Yeah, so thank you very much. He's also the author of the Skepticality podcast theme song that Derek C. works on, so you can check that out. Again, this is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And there's a lot of news going on these days, and I'd be very surprised if you haven't heard by now about the recent news coming out of the Vatican.
Oh, again? But this is good.
Yeah, well, good.
Might be.
Yeah, good in quotes. So what's been going on?
Well, the Pope is gone!
Well, not
well,
yet.
Almost. He's as gone as he's going to be.
Yeah.
He's never leaving Vatican City, I'll tell you that.
You think he's going to be stuck in that part of town?
Well, he doesn't have his diplomatic immunity anymore once he steps down at the end of the month.
I do know there are, at the end of the month, a few meetings being arranged where the Pope is going to try and arrange, or the Vatican's going to try and arrange on his behalf, some immunity within Italy or some other European countries, but I don't know how that's going to go. I don't know if people are going to be so sympathetic to that.
Well, Italy, you know, given their situation with the Vatican, may offer it. Now, I did kind of wonder if maybe immunity by the Vatican would extend towards, like, to most of Rome, because it's not like he's going to be locked in, locked in a town where there's nothing going on. Rome's a pretty large city.
Rome's a large city, but Vatican City is not, except it claims to be a city-state. His immunity, really, as it's recognized, is there.
Okay.
It's smaller than the Mall in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And I would think a bit of delicious irony in the fact that a pope would be basically under house arrest in much the same way that Galileo was.
That, wow, that's a good point. I hadn't considered it, putting it that way.
And I'm happy to have him rot there. I mean, he's really old. I mean, he's like Harold Camping, you know, type old.
Right, right.
Hume Cronin type old. So, I mean, he's not going to be there for very long.
Well, I kind of wonder, you know, he's saying, and the news is that he's stepping down, the first pope to do so in
600 years.
600 years. He's doing it for health reasons, because that's the kind of guy he is.
You mean sick?
Well, sick. But no, he's the kind of guy who would step down if he couldn't do the job, unlike the last 5,000 popes.
Didn't stop Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Ronald Reagan was never pope, if I recall.
Well, he was never really there in the second term.
That's just in comic books. So I just kind of wonder, is he stepping down because of health reasons, or do you think there might be something going on behind the scenes? Like, maybe things are finally catching up to him?
Little column A, little column B.
All right. Well, one of the things that we have to do is when the Pope goes away, everybody's talking about, we're seeing people on the news and people in forums and comments saying that it's great that Ratzinger, you know, former Nazi youth, guy who shielded pederasts, you know, the going away, that's great. But when one is going away, one must look at the replacements. And there's one guy who's sort of the front runner right now, who goes by the name of Cardinal Peter Turkson of Ghana. And he's one of the odds making organizations puts him as the front runner right now. But he's got some weird stuff with him.
Well, he's openly defending the Uganda's Kill the Gays bill. When he was asked about it, he said basically that maybe the gays had brought it upon themselves. Maybe there's a good reason they're being persecuted.
Yeah.
It doesn't really end there. He also said he levied some criticism against the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon for pushing African countries to get rid of their anti-gay legislation. And in these countries, it's actually illegal to be openly gay.
Right, right.
And this is what he said. It gets pretty bad. "The church pushes for the rights of prisoners and the rights of others, and the last thing we need to is infringe upon the rights of anyone. But when you're talking about what's called an alternative lifestyle," and you can just hear the scare quotes on there, "are those human rights? Ban Ki-moon needs to recognize there's a subtle distinction between morality and human rights, and that's what needs to be clarified."
Anytime you have the last thing we want to do is infringe upon the rights of anyone, and then add a but.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think how we can take you seriously as a moral leader if you say, we don't want to infringe on rights, but here's how I'm going to infringe on rights.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always an escape clause for people like this. And it actually does get a little bit worse, is that He has openly called against spending any money on condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS in Africa, given there's an epidemic there,
right.
And says that abstinence is the best measure for fighting it. I think he said that only if there's a married couple and one of them has AIDS should somebody ever be allowed to use condoms. So I guess he's a liberal compared to Benedict?
Maybe, yeah.
But compared to Benedict, you know, I assume Mussolini is a liberal.
Yeah. Well, it just... You know, there's data there in Africa now. A lot of places they've only been talking about abstinence-only education, and its efficacy is very clear. I mean, we can just look at the evidence, and we can put the lie to that.
It fails.
And, you know, we can talk about how it's nice that this Pope who's destructive is leaving, so that means it's an opportunity for somebody who might be a bit more of a reformer to come to the fore. But we're talking about a Vatican with a very conservative culture right now, and that's been put together by the last few popes. And I just don't see I don't see a lot changing here.
No, this isn't like electing a new president of the United States. There've been a really we've had massive changes between presidents that you have a president go away, you know, sort of a Herbert Hoover to FDR kind of swing,
yeah.
That there's a change in the public. But the electorate in voting in the new pope is so small and so ideologically, I guess they would call it pure,
right.
That it's very unlikely there's going to be any kind of change. That if you're going to get somebody as a new pope, they're going to be really, really socially regressive, and they're going to have the same exact opinions on gay people and condoms. It's not going to change.
No.
I think the real thing that I'm going to be keeping my eyes peeled for is, you know, just who comes up now, and not so much changes within the church itself, but changes in how the church is regarded with the rest of the world. I think that this, you know, if in the next few weeks or few months or even years will tell, history will tell what kind of involvement, was going on with Benedict, with Ratzinger, what really was the impetus in his stepping down. Time will tell that, and we'll see how the Vatican can stay as a respected sort of figure in the world stage.
And I'd like to re-extend my offer. I don't really don't have a problem with Catholics as people. I have a big problem with the Vatican. I have a big problem with this Pope, and I'm likely going to have a big problem with whoever the next Pope is. When we talk about the power structures behind these religions, that's really where a lot of my concern is. So if you're a Catholic and you're listening to the show, I really would like to have a conversation with you about what it's like to be a Catholic and to be, assuming if you're listening to this show that you're a somewhat liberal Catholic, and what it's like to be a Catholic in the light of something like this. That's something I'd really like to discuss at some point. It feels a little bit weird to just sort of continue to bag on the Vatican as we've been doing a lot lately. Granted, they've been giving us a lot of really good material, but it feels weird, and I feel like there's a conversation that we could be having there that we're not right now. So I'd like to extend that offer again.
Yeah, I'd really like to ask those people how they can, in any good conscience, give money to an organization that a portion of which is going to be used to protect pedophiles. And
okay, I don't want you at this conversation.
I want to hear it. I want to hear from somebody who clearly isn't somebody who supports the church on this attitude.
Right.
That the uniform reaction that they've had to every single one of these scandals, or to the money being spent to lie about condoms.
But
in
if
Africa.
The first question I come out with in a situation like that is how do you support pedophiles? I don't just want to challenge people. I want to know what people are thinking when they do this. I actually want to know what's inside their head. You know, the kind of conversation that they have with themselves.
Oh, I do.
And I'm not going to lie. I think there's some cognitive dissonance there. But to open up with, how do you feel about pedophiles?
I didn't say I was going to open with it, but it's a question that needs to be asked.
That's the first thing you said, though.
Well, it's the obvious question. I'm not asking
them
now.
It's obvious to you, Mike, but to others who want to just see what Catholics are thinking, what's going through the mind of a Catholic at this pivotal time. I mean, it was only, 6 years ago or so that it was also a pivotal time in the changeover between John Paul and Benedict. So what is going on? I mean, we've had a lot of things in the U.S. where we have the Conference of Women Religious that has been said, hey, you know what, stop doing so much of your charity work, return to pure values. I mean, a lot of people are wanting to progress the Catholic Church forward.
Well, I mean, imagine if you were a member of a political party,
yeah.
And maybe your local organization isn't so bad, but nationally, And at the statewide level, you had horrible stances on issues that are completely the opposite of yours. Oh, well, we're not like them, but you're still giving them money. You're still nominating those candidates.
Right.
You're still backing those people. You're still, when you call yourself a Catholic, saying, that person is my leader. Rather than breaking off and saying, I'm going to be part of the Reformed Catholic Church, you are part of the same organization that employs groups that protect pedophiles.
Internally, I don't think the thinking... I don't think the personal thinking is like that. I don't know, and I don't know what it is. I don't think it's directly equitable between being a Catholic and being a member of a political party. And I would like to know how that works, at least on someone's personal level. And that's why I'm asking for that conversation, is I would really like to know what the thinking is there. It's less challenge and more fact finding.
I'm interested too.
Okay.
I'm not saying that all priests are pedophiles. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that all priests shield pedophiles. I'm not saying that either.
Okay.
What I am saying is that any priest in that, whether the cardinal, bishop, archbishop, whatever, over a certain rank, has their loyalties not to their locality, but to the leadership of the Catholic Church. And it doesn't matter what part of the country, red state, blue state, whatever, they take the exact same social political stances.
Right.
And they're going to override the smaller ones. Those liberal Catholic priests, that guy's never going to become pope. He's never going to become cardinal. He's never become archbishop.
Yeah.
There is a ceiling there. Why are you part of an organization where being sane prevents you from coming up above two bars on your
arm? There is, as we both know, a cherry-picking, take-it-or-leave-it attitude that a lot of people have with religion. And I have a feeling that this might be what's going on here. The kind of person that I might end up talking to might not be the kind of person who gives money to the Catholic Church. I mean, and they're still considered Catholics, and they're still in the Catholic roles, but they may have given up on tithing some time ago.
Oh, and the same thing with the attitude towards contraception. 98% of Catholics have shown that they disagree with the church there.
Right.
Yet, every time you give a money to even one of the good churches, it gets paid up. It's like Amway. It's got the triangle and the Pope is at the top.
Right.
A portion of your donation isn't just going towards fixing the church, but is doing all the things that you dislike, too, and you should acknowledge that.
I get that. I just think that anybody who I might have had a conversation with may have just been scared off a little bit.
If they're still listening to us at this point, we're not going to scare them off now.
You'd be surprised. So we do have some announcements coming up. There's Nick Kennedy, who's been on the show a couple times. He's in a band called Body Box, and they are going to be playing February the 23rd, which is a Seattle at Columbia City, or which is a Saturday in Seattle at Columbia City Theater, which is 4916 Rainier Avenue South in Seattle. It'll be Body Box, True Holland, and In Cahoots. It should be a good show. Tickets are $8 in advance. You can get them on Brown Paper Tickets or $10 at the door. So we've got a quick email, which we might want to do. And this is one, Mike, get ready.
No.
No. This is James from the internet.
Okay.
If Superman existed, would he be a god? What qualities would a being have to have before you would consider it a god?
I don't know. I think that if I lived in a universe with people like Superman, because Superman, if you live in the DC universe, he's kind of ubiquitous. There's a bunch of people who fly around and have powers and stuff like that. What makes him a god versus not? Does he have worshippers? Is he immortal? I don't know. I don't know. I don't necessarily make him a god. Is Q from Star Trek a god? He's more powerful than Superman. He can create life out of non-life. He can essentially be immortal. He can turn any one of his thoughts into reality.
Right. Other than death for dramatic purposes, is Superman ever going to die?
As a fictional character, no.
Yeah, there you go.
He can die, and it certainly makes him different than the way that people would describe the Judeo-Christian god, as I don't assume that he has a kryptonite and there's a way to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that something is all-powerful, unkillable. But then, Hercules, he was killed, and he went into the afterlife and ascended to godhood after that, so
yeah,
he's mortal, kind of. I mean, it's one of those things where the definition of the god really kind of comes to the believer, rather than having this basic criteria that applies across the board.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, do you consider it a god? What's the difference between Superman and Thor? They're both superheroes.
Right.
One of them's called a god, one of them's not.
Hasn't there been storylines in comics where godhood is essentially offered to Superman and he says no?
Well, that happened quite a few times, is that if Superman did exist in the real world, he would acquire worshippers. If you have this guy who's going around the world selflessly saving people and not asking for things in return, you are going to get people who are going to bow down to him. And every time they've done it in the comics, they've always made a big deal of Superman being comfortable with it and rejecting it, saying, I don't want your worship. I'm not comfortable with this. I'm here to help. I'm like, it's like when a cop, you know, stops a mugger from taking your purse. You don't worship him. I'm just doing that on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
I'm here to help.
You know, I think if Superman existed, I mean, if Superman were to, like, miraculously exist right now in front of us and appear in the studio, I think I would be less likely to worship Superman as a god as to become really excited and convinced that we have actually managed to invent time travel, because I'm sure that anyone that would have the powers of Superman would have to come from the future and have that technology in order to harness all of those things.
Okay, so Superman's a Time Lord?
Yes,
okay.
Superman's a Time Lord.
I honestly find Superman to be quite unbelievable, and actually somewhat more believable than the Judeo-Christian God, for certain, but I find it incredibly unbelievable, and I would continue to doubt. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480, and in a minute we'll have some more announcements, some more emails, and some fun interviews.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Or rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's best source of atheist videos. Visit atheismtv.com.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And April 5th to the 7th, the Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference will be held at Portland State University. Principal speakers include Dr. Daryl Ray, author of Sex and God, How Religion Destroys Sexuality. Pretty sure he's been on the show. Hemant Mehta of The Friendly Atheist, who I know has been on the show. Dr. Valerie Tirico, she's a HuffPo and alternate contributor. She's been on the show. She has also been on the show and is also author of Trusting Doubt. And Shelley Segal, who's an Australian folk singer and songwriter who hasn't been on the show yet, but that's something I'd like to fix. Do you sense perhaps a theme here?
I do sense a theme here. And Shelley is just so lovely. We saw her when she was up in Seattle a few months ago, and it should just be a really fun weekend. Awesome weekend. Great.
And so you can go to nwfreethought.org to register and learn more. Register by February 24th and receive the Darwin's birthday discount for entry into the conference. And this was where we did the live episode in 2012, back in March. We are going to be there. We are not doing a presentation like we did last year, but I imagine we'll be doing some show-related stuff that weekend, right?
Yeah, we'll be around and be looking forward to chatting with folks and meeting folks as well.
So we've got another email we're going to do quickly here. This comes to us from Gav from Ohio. Is life better with or without God? Is bread better with mold? Would you rather dip the naked string of a candle in water to see at night or wax. What I'm asking is, why risk your neck for not serving God when you could possibly, in the end, save yourself? I'd rather live like there is one and then find out there isn't than live life without one and find out that there is. Yeah, we all know what this one is.
Well, it's Pascal's Wager is the name of the argument. The basic thing is that we're supposed to decide that it's safer to believe something out of a sense of fear of consequences rather than evidence that it's true.
Yeah.
I think Homer Simpson took this one really nicely. He said, what if we're worshiping the wrong God and every time we go to Mass, we just keep making him madder and madder? I mean, seriously, if a cartoon character known for being an absolute buffoon can handle this question, really, Gav, it's okay. No matter how poetically you state it, I think it's okay. If you live your life well and there happens to be a God, I think whatever God would be worthy of worship and powerful enough to do anything would see that.
And that's the thing is we've talked about Pascal's Wager a lot. I mean, a lot. We've done at least like two episodes just on Pascal's Wager, haven't we?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
gotten any better.
No, there's no new arguments that we've heard. If we've heard some really good ones, we'd certainly tell you about it. We thought this one had an interesting lyrical quality if it did require some editing, but...
Yeah, it was clearly cycled through somebody's memory out of some sermon or poem that they read sometime in the past.
Mm.
Becky fixed some of the grammar. But,
okay.
I guess my big beef with Pascal's Wager is, again, the people who hand out the medicine don't take it themselves. That they basically don't take this same consideration when it comes to, well, am I afraid of going to Muslim hell? Am I afraid of not achieving Nirvana or Valhalla or whatever the reward is? They don't play that game because they simply just assume it's Jesus or nothing.
Yeah. And these Pascal's Wager things always assume that that there is going to be an afterlife and, oh, aren't you going to feel silly? What if there isn't one and you end up spending your life worshiping and serving something that doesn't exist?
Well, you won't feel silly for long.
Right.
I think one of my favorite things is the way my dad introduced it to me as I was 8 years old, because I had a friend die who said her grandmother was in heaven. I have a friend whose grandma died. Grandma was in heaven. And I said, well, what happens in heaven? And my dad said, you know, honey, there's really no way to know. Nobody knows. We're going to die and there's going to be a big fat Buddha sitting at Peter's gates wearing a yarmulke and everyone will laugh at it. I mean, that was my way of understanding that nobody really knows what God is like if there's an afterlife. And to me, that said, there probably isn't one.
So heaven's about laughing at fat people?
But to me,
there are skinny Buddhas.
If I may, it's more about, do I really want to waste my life worshiping something that there's no evidence for? And that hasn't really done anything in history.
And then
period.
Once you die, you get to worship it some more.
Yeah.
How did Christopher Hitchens say it?
Not
Day
like,
to dawn, it's like North Korea.
Yeah, okay. Not my point, though. My point is entirely temporal.
Yeah.
Is if we choose to, you know, if he's like, oh, there might be a God, so I'm going to worship it so I don't get in trouble. Well, what if it doesn't matter, and then you've had one shot, and you've wasted it? I that sounds even less good to me.
I
would rather make the life I've got better than pretend that I'm going to get pie in the sky when I die.
So
exactly.
So here's the thing. Trying to make a candle out of water in order to see at night, you know, won't get you anything. But trying to live your life well, not knowing, worshiping a god, you know that there is a benefit to that.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a really fun interview today. Joining us is Seth Andrews, former Christian broadcaster, host of the widely popular Thinking Atheist podcast, and the author of the new book, Deconverted, A Journey from Religion to Reason. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. So you spent 30 years as a practicing Christian. Briefly, what changed your mind?
Well, you know, I didn't practice for about the last decade. It was the last decade. There, I was probably what I called dormant in the faith. I think I just essentially checked out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was raised, I was immersed in the Christian culture from my earliest memories, and a Christian broadcaster surrounded by people who agreed with me. I was never really challenged, never heard or read the work of an evolutionary biologist or cosmologist that wasn't a believer. And finally, as I approached the tender age of 40, sort of all of the doubts that had been pinging the back of my skull drove me to go a little bit deeper, and when I started to actually dig, lo and behold, I had to reject everything I'd been raised upon.
So in your case, it was actually looking at scientific evidence and just actually testing the strictures to see if they worked, or was there a...
Well, there were a few major events. I mean, I was a Christian broadcaster in 1997. There was an artist named Rich Mullins, a beloved artist, who was horribly, violently killed in a Jeep accident. And, of course, we're on the air charged to give words of comfort. He is now in heaven. He has been called home. And as I said those words to our audience, it just rang false. This was God's master plan, you know, to raise him to the forefront of ministry and then have him violently killed, give his family a closed casket, send his legions of fans into mourning. It just makes no sense. And then after 9/11, watching everybody invoke God and seeing essentially no God, but just a cause and effect event that could be explained by natural means, those two major events and about 1,000 small ones really caused an unrest in me. Look, this isn't washing. Everybody's talking about God, but he's like the party guest who never showed up. And, you know, those types of events really spurred me into finally asking hard questions and demanding genuine answers. You know, when you're a Christian, you're not supposed to demand answers. You're supposed to have faith. And I was emboldened finally to expect. Why should I be afraid to ask a legitimate question and expect a legitimate answer in return?
So one of the interesting things about your story is that you were a broadcaster. You went from being a broadcaster on Christian radio to a very popular atheist podcast. What was that transition like?
Well, I loved my Christian radio days, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, I was grew up on the music. Even now, you know, I don't listen to the music, but if I hear an old Third Day song, I find myself wistful in a few ways. And I loved the audience; they were just precious people. And you know, you never really get radio out of your blood. It just, you know, you guys know what that's like. I mean, we've all known people who were in the business, burned out, and they left, but they always remember the day. You know, they miss that conduit, the storyteller, the performer, the ham, all of these things that radio does for you.
Right.
And jumping back into it, I thought maybe there seems to be a challenge in the non-believing community of producing good storytelling. I mean, they have a lot of good content, but presenting it in a palatable way. There's a lot of really egg-heady type stuff out there. Somebody with a PhD behind a podium who's talking to a group of 500 people. They've got a Sony Handycam in the back of the room, and they consider that to be a compelling product. No. And as a producer and a broadcaster, I wanted to bring people closer into the conversation. And what better way to do that than with the one-on-one medium of radio?
Yeah.
And it's taken off. I mean, even though February is a short month, we're on track to hit 400,000 downloads this month, which is amazing.
Wow, that's great.
I'll take it.
Yeah, in my case, that was, you know, something that I really want to do with radio too. Radio has always been a love of mine, and that I kind of saw the same thing, which was atheism and non-believer podcasts tend to be of sort of the expert lecture type, where you have an expert and then people listen to the expert. Where I thought, you know, maybe what we could do, since I'm not an expert on much, is, and this was the conversation that Mike and I had on this, where we really started to gel, was let's make it about people. Let's not explain atheism is just for the purposes of explaining it, but let's present ourselves as atheists and our friends as atheists and the people that we talk to, just in a conversational stance, just to see what kind of people we are.
Well, I think people, I mean, you have just described, I think, why your show and my show are resonating with people. They, you know, I have the utmost respect and awe for people like Lawrence Krauss.
And
those guys are tremendous when it comes to giving us information. But how about an experience where people take the journey with us? How about when you go on the air and you say, you know what, I had this experience with a family member, or I felt this, or I experienced this kind of discrimination, or I have these questions or doubts or this or that. And you essentially are inviting people who can relate to you as an every person to take the journey with you. And you are connected. And, you know, I don't care where technology goes, video, the internet, anything. I honestly believe that for the reason that we are connecting one-on-one with an audience, creating those relationships, that radio will always exist. I just think that the audio-only conversation in some capacity will always be there. People will listen and bring you into these very private parts of their lives and make you a part of their family. And for that, I'm tremendously grateful.
Could not agree more.
So you had that relationship with your Christian audience and now with your non-believing audience. Has anyone crossed over? Has there been an audience member or fan from your Christian radio days that continues to listen to you now?
I'll tell you, I did a book signing in Tulsa yesterday. We got the entire second floor of McNally's Pub, and there's probably 70 people. We're all hanging out. And I ran into two or three people who, and I hate it when they say this, they say, I used to listen to you when I was a kid. And, of course, I always throw up in my mouth a little bit. Oh, thank you for that. But they listened when they were believers. And they, in their own journey, their own circle, came to reject it and discovered me after the fact. It's this weird sort of full circle thing. I have had some people who are Christian radio listeners and remember me from those days who've come back to me to pray for me, to ask me, you know, how could you do this? But I'm surprised at the number of people that I have run into who they sort of on their own came to that point of critical mass and walked away from religion. And then they discovered me and they said, hey, wow, imagine that. What a coincidence. You know, it's pretty amazing.
So that's the sort of difference between just being a believer in the pews who leaves the church, because you don't have an audience watching you as you do it, who've felt attached to you from a distance as you do it. Now that you've gone from sort of one place to another, have you had to sort of start from scratch, or have you kept any of the relationships that you had from Christian radio?
I don't... I'm not as wired into radio as I was, obviously. I left full-time radio in 2003 to become a full-time video producer, and that has been my trade. And honestly, the vast majority of people that I'm wired in with, family and friends, remain believers, and they are people who are precious to me. They're not idiots, they're not stupid, they're not all the horrible verbal grenades that we tend to throw at the non-believer in the atheist community. Sometimes you'll see that, you know, we lead by insult. Quite frankly, these are people who most likely were raised in the cocoon of religion. They were indoctrinated at an early age. Everybody in their community is Christian. There are churches on every quarter block. There's no real challenge, and everybody around here is just comfortable, you know. But they're really beautiful people, and I've lost a few friends, but not many. It has been tremendously difficult for my mother and father, as they believe now that their extreme efforts to raise a God-fearing child and rescue him from hell have failed, and they personally believe they are responsible for not doing enough, and that I will be damned. And that's a pretty horrifying thing for a mother and father.
I can imagine. Now, Seth, in your book, Deconverted, A Journey from Religion to Reason, do you discuss any of those kinds of things about your relationship with your parent? And what other kinds of things do you discuss in that book?
I do. I mean, many people, especially lifelong atheists, have a difficult time figuring out, why did it take this chowderhead so long to get out of this? To understand that there was not a global flood with a 600-year-old pilot of a floating zoo. You know, what's the matter with this guy? And I have to, maybe it's my defense mechanism, but I have to draw a circle around the power of indoctrination. And in the book, I chronicle at our earliest ages, we were placed in extremely insulated private schools where you didn't just pledge allegiance to the American flag, you pledged an allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Bible. I can recite those pledges today. We started every classroom with prayer. We prayed before every meal. We were just brainwashed. I mean, we were just programmed. And I chronicle that. And I talk about, I really want to make sure that I try to respect my family, but I have to address a few family issues in the book. And I do, how I approached my parents, who are both trained theologians, what it was like going through that extremely difficult sort of revelation to them that I am now rejecting all of the theology that they hold so dear, and how we've managed to come to an uneasy peace. We love each other, but even those of you who have families who are devoutly religious know what it's like to be in the room with someone, and even though you're not talking about religion or God, seems to always be there. You know?
Yeah, it and seems like the wrong verb in the wrong place starts that conversation up right away.
Well, it's the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Or occasionally I'll get this one, and it doesn't happen as often anymore, but you'll be at a long dinner table with 15 people, and somebody at one end, not even looking at you, will look at the person at the other end and go, by the way, did you read that article the other day that showed proof that the theory of evolution is absolute nonsense and that scientists are rejecting it? It's amazing. You really should check it out. Now, they're not looking at me, but they're talking to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty obvious.
I hate passive aggression. I'm kind of curious now, because now you've tried to drop this book out there, so every Thanksgiving you go to, this is going to be a topic of discussion. Has anyone in your family read the book?
We don't. No, not to my knowledge. And I haven't. I mean, they're aware of my TTA activities, the Thinking Atheist TTA for short. But I think they have really opted out. It's a source of shame. You know, we're talking about a culture of people who speak with pride, tremendous gratification about things like soul winning. You know, we are out there winning souls. And I think that they are, instead of being focused on what I am doing now, they watch from the sidelines, and I think they're drawing a real measure of attention toward what they consider to be the most vulnerable minds in the family. You know, they're going after making sure that the grandkids and the young nieces and nephews aren't left alone to receive any messages. I think they're really focusing on trying to protect all of the young minds out there from
influence. It sounds a bit like they're treating you like a pedophile. Not to put sharp a point on it, but that sounds kind of creepy.
I don't see it in that way. It's honestly, I think they see me as deceived, that I am going through whatever they want to call it, a midlife crisis. I've had some kind of a meltdown. It's an attack of the evil one, what have you.
Right.
And they honestly believe that I, if they were to allow me too much influence in the lives of, say, you know, a 7-8-year-old kid who's in my family. I mean, they haven't done anything overt. It's really all, it's all kind of under the surface. It's all, you know, whenever they get them together, they want to talk to the children about things like the second law of thermodynamics. Well, boy, that'll blow a 12-year-old's hair back. Wow, thanks, Grandma. Let's talk about thermodynamics. You know, and in the meantime, you know, those of us who have heard the argument always realize that they're just cherry-picking tiny scientific catchphrases, have no idea what the other three laws are. You know, it's really a pretty lazy attempt to try to create a culture of confirmation bias.
Absolutely. So there's one question that we'd like to wrap up with, and this is a question that we ask anybody who used to be prominent Christians who are now atheists. We like to call it our TARDIS challenge. If you were to hop into a time machine and meet your past Christian self, how do you think you'd regard each other?
You know, I don't think I met an atheist that I can think of when I was that age. If I had come across me, I think we might have been buds. I mean, I don't think I would have been open, especially at the beginning, to anything that the atheist Seth was saying or doing.
Right.
But you know, the fact that I love people and that I love to laugh and all of those types of things, I would hope would have kept those barriers from going up between us, those lines of demarcation that keep people from treating each other like people. And even though we disagreed, I'd like to think we would have been friends. And who knows, maybe that would have led to some serious conversations.
So your book, Deconverted, A Journey from Religion to Reason, is currently available on Amazon. I know you're looking at a book tour. Any possibility of you heading out this way anytime soon?
I would love to. You know, my work obligations and family have got me pretty close to the Southwest geographically. But I'm hoping to expand beyond the Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Texas kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Looking at Colorado. I've had some invitations to Florida, which I'm excited about. I'm hoping to make that happen. And the West Coast would be amazing. Nothing on the immediate itinerary, but I'm hoping perhaps later in 2013.
Well, perhaps we can put something together. Seth Andrews is a former Christian broadcaster, is the host of a wildly popular Thinking Atheist podcast, and the author of Deconverted, A Journey from Religion to Reason. I look forward to reading the book. I'm hearing some really good stuff about it. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We'll be back in a minute.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide a bajillion dollars in your locker.
Wow, a bajillion dollars?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. Joining us now is Donald R. Wright, a former Baptist deacon, the author of The Only Prayer I'll Ever Need, Let My People Go. And he was originally hailed from Alabama. He's currently an engineer in Houston, where he's also the member of the Humanists of Houston. He joins us today to talk about the third annual Day of Solidarity with Black Nonbelievers, an event he first organized in 2011. Welcome, Donald.
Donald, are you with us today?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. So tell us, what were the forces behind the very first Day of Solidarity in 2011?
Well, I think the whole point was that in my journey was pretty, I guess it's relatively new considering it started in 2006. And so the idea of moving out of religion, particularly from the black culture and religion, it has been challenging from the standpoint of being able to associate and build relationships with other black non-believers. So in recognizing that, during Black History Month of 2011, I was just kind of pondering the idea of being able to have more information about black non-believers from a historical perspective. And so from that came the idea that I would solicit a day during Black History Month in which we could ask black non-believers all over the country to just come together for a day of fellowship and to use that time to build community activism and to promote and focus in on other black non-believers. Particularly from a historical standpoint. So that was the driving mechanism that kind of guided me into wanting to start something like this.
And the first one you started was in Houston, correct?
Well, we had one in Houston, and there was one in L.A. It was one in Washington, D.C., I think. So it was three or four locations that particular year.
And we're looking at growing this year. Now, last year, you had contacted over 400 groups and individuals requesting this kind of support and participation, but you reported that over 90% of those inquiries were met with silence, while some even really groused at the thought. Why do you think this was the case?
Well, I think I'm still trying to figure out what's the issue behind that. But I think the idea of trying to get more black non-believers out of the closet, per se, is still a challenge. But also, there is seem to be some hesitancy in regards to how the non-black secular community is is somewhat reaching out and being all-inclusive in terms of the roles that black non-believers can play in the secular organizations. So in my journey, I've attended a few conventions and conferences and things like that, and most of them are dominated by whites. So I don't know exactly to I really can't explain the why it really hasn't caught on yet, or why people didn't respond. But the idea here is that it's a very simple concept, and so I'm still trying to figure out why even black people are not responding. So, but the idea is very simple. It's very cost effective. It's a local engagement. All you have to do is find somebody else that's a non-believer and take the opportunity on that particular day and sit down and chat and have coffee or something.
So that would be very
minimal.
For some of the leaders of particular local organizations who don't happen to be of African-American heritage, how do you suggest that that these groups celebrate or observe or promote this day of solidarity?
Well, one thing they can do is just, first of all, advertise it. They can put it up on their websites or anything like that and just talk about it or announce it anyway to say to at least identify that this particular event is taking place. And then within their organization, there are things that they can do to acknowledge it, the same as what organizations do in terms of acknowledging Black History Month. So that particular day, if they so choose, they could just acknowledge historical Black free thinkers on that particular day. That could be a minimum thing that they could do.
I know that there's some really nice information out there on the African Americans for Humanism website and things like that. Is that
right?
Are there any other resources that you would suggest?
Well, I think there's some great books that are coming out now. Sikivu Hutchinson has a great book, Moral Combat. Anthony Penn has done some great writings about it. Norm Allen also has done books about the history of African Americans and humanism. So those are some other resources.
So I'm going to ask kind of a tough question here. Now, your colleague Naima Washington, she wrote in a piece, she said, based on their disinterest in recruiting efforts, just in general, like, not proselytizing as religious people do, the leadership of the secular community is apparently very proud of the fact that they have no persons of African descent in leadership positions, as well as very few members. Now, Donald, do you agree with that sentiment in light of outreach efforts within the AHA and American Atheists, in addition to some of the, you know, prominent thinkers that you've named and organizations, at the local level and things like that, and these people counting themselves amongst the leadership of organized free thought efforts?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the use of the word proud or being happy about it. I'm not absolutely certain about that. Naima has been around in this movement for a long time, and I am very happy and excited that I've been able to build a relationship with her. And I've been knowing her for 3 years now. But I think there is some type of point has to be made in regards to the leadership of the secular communities. And so where is the non-whites from that perspective? So I think it's a point now of encouraging those organizations to be all-inclusive, to show diversity and support diversity. Mm-hmm. Not just talk about it, but actually demonstrate it.
Now, Don, what was one of the things that you found helpful in you being, you know, associating with Humanists of Houston and sort of you coming out into the fore, into this visible role in the freethought community?
Well, the most important thing to me is being able to just have that community, that fellowship, finding like-minded people, which is I think is very important, particularly in this particular journey. And so that's what I found to be a most significant component. But the other thing that helped me a lot was being able to identify my worldview now. by the fact that I was escaping religion, which was very dominant in my life. Now I was moving away from that. So I had to try to understand and define those things that was going to be the governing factors to define my worldview. And Humanists of Houston, that group, and then learning more about humanism has helped me tremendously from that perspective.
So this is the third year of the Day of Solidarity event. What do you see as sort of the growth arc for the event? How do you see this going on in the next year and the year after that? Just more local organizations involved? Would you like to see sort of a national event or anything like that?
Well, I like for it to stay local in its intent because I think it's very important from a local standpoint that is utilized from that perspective, because my motivation is to provide a reach out mechanism so that more black non-believers would have this opportunity to realize that there are more people out there and that there is a way in which they can develop relationships and meet more people in this area of non-belief. And so the local gatherings are the most critical, and that's what I hope continues. And so I hope that within the next couple of years that we could have a gathering that takes place in at least all 50 states and some local communities.
So where would be the best place for organizers and community members to get in touch with you and to make sure that you reach that goal of getting in all 50 states?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page. We also have the Facebook page is entitled Black Non-Believe the Day of Solidarity for Black Non-Believers.
Okay.
So that's the name of the Facebook page. We have an email on there, and also you can also contact me through the African American for Humanism or Humanists of Houston. And also, I'm excited to be part of another organization here in Houston called Houston Oasis, which is a growing free thought community, which we gather weekly. So I'm working diligently with that organization also.
All right. We'll make sure to put those in the show notes to make sure that people know to go. I understand. When one is running a community organization, when you send out a lot of email, a lot of that email can easily get swept under the rug. So I'm glad,
right.
I'm glad that you got, we managed to talk about this today, because this gets the word out there. And I agree with you. I'd really like to see this in all 50 states.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it's interesting because it was very lonely for me, coming into this newfound way of life or escaping religion. Is such a
yeah.
It's such a deep deep part of our culture, and so being able to find particularly other black people was very important for me. But it was very difficult. It was a significant challenge, and so when I came out, I took on the attitude that I don't mind being a spokesperson. I don't mind talking about it. So if I'm going to be the point guy to discuss this, I don't mind. And so because I see it as being very significant in our community to at least talk about this.
Donald R. Wright is a former Baptist deacon, is the author of The Only Prayer I'll Ever Need, Let My People Go. He's from Alabama, currently lives in Houston. He's an engineer, and he's a member of Humanists of Houston, and now the Houston Oasis Group. Is that the name of your new organization?
Yeah, Houston Oasis, yes. The name of the book is The Only Prayer I'll Ever Pray.
Pray. Oh, okay. Okay, my notes.
Okay.
All right. Sorry about that. We'll make sure to get that changed in the show notes. Again, there'll be links to all of these things. I look forward to hearing from you again. I'd like to hear how the event goes and sort of do some more stuff in subsequent years. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you all for having me on. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We've got another email we should probably do here. All right. So Stephen writes, it's not quite on the level of anti-vaccinations, but I learned recently that Bellingham doesn't fluoridate its water.
Bellingham,
right, wrong place.
We're not England.
Right. Fluoridation measures have been rejected several times, thanks to conspiracy theorists. So fluoridation, real quick, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who tend to very quickly go into a Soylent Green mindset about anything. that there's something in our water that isn't water. It must be people.
I think one of the things that I've been hearing about this is this chemophobia or chemicophobia, where you assume that anything that has a chemical name to it is automatically bad for you. And that's just one of those, logical fallacies that says, you know, you're appealing to something ancient. You're appealing to that which is natural.
Yeah.
Which it does not mean that it's logical.
It's funny because water has a chemical name too.
Well, everything that is made of atoms and molecules is made of chemicals.
Is a chemical. And there's the difference between natural and unnatural chemicals or whatever. I imagine we might talk about fluoridation someday.
Yeah.
Now, would we talk about it specifically about fluoridation or in sort of a larger conspiracy theory episode?
Well, I think it'd probably be a larger conspiracy theory episode. It's the mindset behind it. The idea that anything that's there must have some sort of sinister purpose for being there, that it's mind control chemicals or that it's there to sterilize poor people or some nonsense.
So very quickly, I'd like to thank Stephanie from Spokane, Michael from Louisville, Texas, Mark from Shawnigan, British Columbia, Shane from Miami, Florida, Charles from Brookline, Massachusetts, and Chris from Joburg, South Africa, for your donations to Peggy's challenge to help keep the show going. If you don't have a lot of money, but you'd like to help out the show anyway, I'd like to introduce you to something we're starting up, which is the Ask an Atheist listener poll. And if you go to poll.askanatheist.tv, that's a website, it'll take you to our winter 2013 listener poll, where we ask you some questions about you know, what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show, and a few questions about yourself that might help us out. You'll help us, it'll help us pick a future direction of the show, tell us about the kind of people who listen to the show, and sort of give us an idea about the atheism community that we serve. So, I guess that's all the time we've got for today. My name is Sam... My name is Sam Mulvey. With me today was Mike Gillis and Rebecca Friedman. I was not expecting that soundtrack. Ask an Atheist is an NEDM Media production. There is no post-show today. It's my birthday party, so...
Happy birthday, Sam.
Happy
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Sam.
And we will see you guys. You can go to askanatheist.tv. You can see us next week, maybe.
Clay Radio, your conversation station.